everybody. I'm Paulette. I'm an addict. I live in La Quinta, California, which is in the Coachella Valley, where we have the music festivals and Palm Springs and all sorts of fun stuff out here. My clean date is September 17th, 1996. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about what my life was like, what it was like getting clean, what it was like being a closet atheist for most of my recovery. And when I came out of that dark place, that dark closet, how it transformed my recovery. So I'm not going to get too much into the drugs, but I just want you to be able to identify with me. So I'll go into them a little bit. I grew up in Europe. My family was working for the US government. So I was going to school in France and Germany and a bunch of different places. I had supportive, educated parents that loved me and my three sisters. So we moved to California in, I don't even remember now, in like 1965, something like that. And when I was about 12 years old, my parents started having problems in their marriage. And they forgot they had four kids that were like 14, 12, 10, and 8. My dad started to drink. And ironically, maybe coincidentally, probably not, I picked up my first drug, which was a cigarette when I was 12 years old. My dad was 40. And I got my first boyfriend. And the reason I bring up the boyfriend is because a lot of my story centers around codependency. And I mean, the drugs were killing me, of course, and they are definitely a problem for me. But I believe that I was codependent first, and then I became addicted. So my dad starts to drink. He moves out. My mom starts bringing home strange men to our home, and it's very confusing. Like, who are these people, and why are they, you know, in my mom's bedroom overnight? And like, it was very confusing for me. So I, you know, I have a boyfriend, he breaks up with me, my heart is broken. Like, I'm starting to learn how to change the way I am because I don't want people to leave me. So I started smoking, like I said. Not only is my story about codependency, but it's also about neglect and the poor decisions a child makes without guidance. Like, growing up on my own, I was not prepared to make the decisions that I was forced to make. I thought that if I had a boyfriend, that I would be okay. And I learned how to change how I was so people would stay with me. Like, I was seeking love and acceptance and approval. And I thought I would find that in, at the time, they were boys. And I just want to talk a little bit about my first experience with the drug nicotine. And, you know, I know nicotine isn't one of the big ones, but it was a big one for me because it was the hardest one for me to quit. Somebody drove by and threw a lit cigarette out the window of my elementary school because the sixth grade was at elementary school back then. And I ran out there and I picked it up and I took a big hit off of it. And I got dizzy and I thought I was going to fall down. And I thought, oh my gosh, I can't wait to do this again. I loved the way it took me out of my own brain and my own thought process. And I thought, oh, this is the greatest thing I've ever experienced. So I liked the way I felt when I was intoxicated from the get-go. At 13, I was smoking pot. I think I was doing a little bit of cocaine and I had sex for the first time. And it wasn't because I wanted to, it was because my friend's older brother wanted me to. And I thought that was a perfectly fine reason. So I'm learning to change myself. And I'm also learning as a young, cute, blonde girl that sex is a tool. And it's a way to manipulate people into doing what I want them to do. These are my 13-year-old revelations. So I'm learning to people please. I'm learning to do what other people want. I'm learning to that my needs aren't as important as yours. At 15, I started using IV heroin. And I remember because, you know, I wanted to fit in so badly. I'm with this group of people. I have this older boyfriend. He's 18 and they're all doing this stuff. And I want to be a part of it. And I stick my arm out and I turn my head because I did not care for needles. And that feeling that I got from that drug, I interpreted as love. And I was going to do. I remember thinking, this is what I've been looking for my entire life. This is better than nicotine. This is better than weed. This is better than all that other stuff that I'd been using, that I was going to do this thing. And it's interesting because I'm 15 years old. I'm with this group of people and they are like, I grew up in this, this family with rules and we were very middle class. We were very white bread. I don't know how else to describe that. Like nobody was hit. There was no violence going on. But this group that I wanted to be a part of was violent. They were robbing people. They had guns. They had all these things I didn't have any experience with. And this is where when somebody threatened to, I think they were either going to shoot me or punch me in the face. I don't remember. I'd never been in a fight in my life because I said something that made this gal feel dumb. And she thought that I thought I was so much smarter than her and how dare you, and we're going to fuck you up and all this stuff. That's where I learned that it was safer to be small. It was safer to be quiet. It was safer to not bring attention to myself. And at 15 years old, I started living in other people's shadows. And I was quite comfortable doing that because it was a lot safer than expressing myself and getting beat up. Didn't want to get beat up. So I learned how to dumb it down and not be myself and to be what you wanted me to be. I forgot to mention, also at 15, I got pregnant and all of the problems that caused. I just, you know, I didn't know what I was doing and I didn't have anybody guiding me except these other people who didn't know what they were doing either. So fast forward, I'm a heroin addict. I'm a meth addict. I'm an everything addict. I got Hep C. I haven't been to the doctor in, oh my God, I don't even know how long. I haven't been to the dentist. My teeth are falling out. I have pleurisy. I have all these things wrong with me and I cannot stop using. So the thing one of the many things that pushed me in the direction of getting clean was, my family did an intervention on me, and I still remember it as the worst day of my life, even though it was probably the best day. But I remember being very scared. And they're telling me, we see you doing all this stuff. We're watching you hurt yourself. We want you to stop. And I'm like, no, I can't. I'm not going to stop. But I will start being honest. And my mom, who doesn't even drink, she's very naive about all this stuff, calls me. You know, every day, oh, did you go over to that house with the drugs and the guns and the bad people? Did you inject anything? And she's asking me all these questions and I'm saying yes, because I said I'd be honest. I was as honest as I was capable of. And she was so freaked out that her daughter was living this life that she didn't even recognize me. She thought I was a monster. I remember her telling me that afterwards and she stopped asking those questions. So me having that effect on my mom was very helpful. It was one of the cogs in the wheel that was pushing me. I agreed to go into a detox hospital, brought drugs with me. But an NA panel came in there and started talking about, I mean, these folks had 6 months, maybe a year clean, and they were telling my story and they were talking about being clean and being happy and how it was possible not to suffer anymore. And I believe because their language and they were talking about things that I had done, that they had done these things too, I believe them. And one of the reasons I love the third step, which I mean, sorry, the third tradition, is the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using. And I wanted to stop and I couldn't. And my husband at the time bought me a NA basic text, and I'm carrying that around with me to the connections house. I was one of those annoying addicts who does that. And because I was reading in there and I was reading about myself, and I was so encouraged that maybe I didn't have to suffer anymore, that maybe I had something better coming. So I was going to meetings loaded, and I don't know if anybody knew, but they hugged me and told me to keep coming back. And I believed them, and I did. And it took me about 8 months to go back into the detox hospital and not bring drugs with me. And then I started going to meetings. And then the thing about being a closet atheist is, like, I want to belong to a group. I needed desperately to belong somewhere. And I had chosen NA, so I was going to be whatever they wanted me to be. And I thought they wanted me to be a believer in God and a higher power and all that business. So I tried. I looked for this thing that seemed to bring comfort to so many people. I joined the Episcopal Church. I joined the choir. I went on their weekend retreats. I was confirmed and baptized, and I wanted to be open to this thing. I wanted it to find me. I wanted to find it, and it did not reveal itself to me. But I continued to play the role of a good NA member, and my higher power this, my higher power that. I didn't talk about that like that too much. Like, I didn't really give credit for my successes to my higher power. I didn't do that, but I was in it. I was a closet atheist. And the thing about giving credit for my hard work to something I had that had yet to reveal itself to me was so distasteful to me, because I had been giving myself away my entire life. And I thought, I can't do that. I just can't do that. And around, I want to say 2014, I don't know exactly, something like that. Shoot, I don't remember the details of this. Someone had invited me to a secular meeting in a Buddhist temple. And it was the other fellowship, which I didn't really, wasn't my favorite, but I thought, oh, I'll check this out. And I went, and in the beginning, it was a lot of, like this higher power bullshit. I just can't do it anymore. It was a lot of that. And then it kind of calmed down into just talking about recovery without bashing other people's, beliefs. And it fit my nervous system so much better. Then the other fellowship had a conference in Santa Monica in 2016, where I met Ken and my sponsor at the time, and I went, and it was a whole bunch of us that were non-believers, and nobody's hit by lightning, and nobody is in trouble, and people are loving me anyways. And I'm starting to feel more comfortable being myself and not pretending to be something I'm not. Working the steps has been a little bit problematic, or it was problematic, because I always had to edit. I always had to take out the higher power references and the gods, and I always had to do that. But there are so many versions of the steps now that take a supreme being out of the mix. And So when I work the steps, which I still do, I haven't done it in a couple of years, but I have sponsees. I have one sponsee who is religious and, it works for her. I'm cool with that. One who is an atheist like me, and two, excuse me, three who are atheists like me. And I just tell people, edit it to make it meaningful to you, or just ignore it completely. You want your recovery is yours, mine is mine, and you have to do what works for you. So when I work the steps, the first step is I admit that I'm powerless over my addiction, it's making my life unmanageable. That's kind of easy. And then number two is I just want to stay connected to my source. Whatever my source is NA. So I stay connected to NA. And step three is basically the same thing. Step four, I make a searching and fearless moral inventory. I write down all the things that I've done that are unskillful, and I share it with another person. In step five, that's the sharing of another person. At step six and seven, like I analyze what are the things about me that I'm doing that's creating my problems that I talked about in step four. What are they? I'm afraid of making a mistake. Fear is my big thing. I'm afraid of being taken advantage of. I'm afraid of not being accepted. Those are mostly my codependencies that are still unhealed wounds in me that drive my behavior and make me act unskillfully. See, I don't like the word character defects because I'm not defective. I'm perfect, and I'm perfectly imperfect. So in step eight, I make a list of people I've harmed, and I become willing. Step nine, I make those amends to them when I can, unless it will hurt me or them. One of the mistakes that I made in early recovery is I went right to step nine, and I went to my brother-in-law and I told him, I used to drive around my little three-year-old nephew when I was drunk out of my mind. And like he was freaked out, and I didn't know what I was doing. And so I highly urge you, don't just do the steps in an order. Like it prepares me for a door slammed in my face in step nine, if that's what happens. Step 10, I continue to take personal inventory, and when I'm wrong, promptly admit it. I am not afraid of making a mistake most of the time because that's where I learn the most. And my mind is open enough because I've worked these steps that I'm cool. I'm cool with mistakes today. And 11 is, continued meditating, or however you want to get quiet and become in tune with the universe. However you want to do that. Like, what's your, and I don't like the word spiritual. I haven't really come up with a better one, but what do you do to stay centered? And then in step 12, I try to carry the message to other people who are suffering from this disease. So I had a experience the other day that I hadn't had in a long time when a person relapsed. And I haven't communicated with a person who's relapsed in a long time. But the more important part of that is, like, because I'm mostly on online meetings, like I don't get to experience the suffering that new people go through. And I think it's really good for me to experience that. Like, I don't take it on and I don't suffer too, but I don't want to be, how do I want to say that? Like, I need to see when someone new is suffering. I need to experience that. It's good for me. It reminds me. And it also creates empathy and sympathy. And it makes it like, it reminds me that carrying the message is so important to other people. Like, it's not just about me. I have enough clean time where, like, I have a really big tent. I can do a lot of things. I can share a lot about myself. I can do a lot about that stuff. I'm thinking that my time is up, but I'm not seeing where Ken's doing his thing. Oh, it was 2014. Okay. Anyway, I think I've said enough. I feel like I might have been a little bit disjointed, but That's okay. My sponsor always tells me you can't screw up your own story. So that is my encouragement to everybody who is afraid to tell theirs. We will love you no matter what. So I'm going to keep coming back. Thanks.